Welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller. And if you have a couple extra pounds that you're trying, you just can't lose, or maybe even more than that, you're going to be happy to hear from our first guest, Lucy Afremore. She's written a book called Body Respect, and it talks about what conventional health books get wrong and leave out and just fail to plain fail to understand about weight loss. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking with Diana Steele about the research she has done around sugar. But before we do that, here's Reg with the health news.
A compound extracted from broccoli sprouts may improve some social and behavioral problems that affect people with autism, new study suggests. The study was short-term and small, including just over 40 teenage boys and young men with autism. And experts stress that no one is saying broccoli or its extracts is a magic bullet. It is also important to note that not everybody responded to the treatment. About one-third of those treated with the compound didn't have a positive response. The compound in question is called sulforaphane, and it's naturally found in broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables. The chemical has been widely studied for its potential benefits against cancer, but in the new study reported on October 13th in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences Online, researchers chose to test sulforaphane as an autism therapy. Positive, calm, and friendly family meals might help a child avoid becoming overweight or obese, a new study suggests. University of Minnesota researchers say children seem to be less likely to add on extra pounds if their family meals feature pleasant conversation, positive encouragement, and no disorder caused by kids acting out. For the study, they watched dozens of hours of video recordings of family meals. Normal weight children were more likely to have family meals during which parents offered encouraging statements and everyone seemed to enjoy each other's company. Negativity at the table seemed to be associated with obesity. The findings were published online October 13th in the journal Pediatrics. According to a new study, regularly eating fried food before pregnancy may increase a woman's risk of developing diabetes during pregnancy. Researchers examined more than 21,000 single-child pregnancies in the United States over more than 10 years. Compared to women who ate fried food less than once a week before pregnancy, the investigators found the risk of gestational diabetes was 13% higher in those who ate fried food 1 to 3 times a week. In addition, the risk was 31% higher in women who ate fried foods 4 to 6 times a week, and the researchers report the risk more than doubled in women who consumed 7 or more servings weekly. The association between fried food and an increased risk of gestational diabetes was stronger with fried foods eaten in restaurants than with fried foods consumed at home, according to the report published in the journal Diabetologia. And finally, new research suggests the size of your dining companions may influence how much you eat. The heavier the people who eat with you or near you are, the more food you are likely to eat, and the less likely that food is to be healthy, according to researchers. In the study, evaluation was made on how much food people consumed when they ate with an actress who wore a fat suit that made her 50 pounds heavier, and when they ate with the same person without her fat suit. Findings indicate people who were eating with a person who is notably overweight ended up eating about 32% more pasta and about 43% less salad. The study was published online recently in the journal Appetite.
Well, thanks for that, Reg. Our first guest, Lucy Afremore, is a PhD and a registered dietitian. She's co-authored a book called Body Respect, what conventional health books get wrong, leave out, and just plain fail to understand about weight. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave.
So let's start out by talking a little bit about, you know, the research you've done in this area and how you first got interested in it.
Okay, thanks. So I was first interested when I was working as a dietitian, and I saw very early on that the people that came to me mostly for help around weight loss weren't actually any healthier, it seemed, or any happier for their efforts. And people would often tell me that they felt lazy or they were a failure. And in fact, when I listened to their stories, people had invested the whole of their adult lives in trying to diet. So I began to look into the research. I couldn't work out what it was that I was doing wrong. And what I found was that what I'd been telling my clients, you know, just eat less and exercise more, believing in good faith that was going to lead to a pretty sort of predictable rate of weight loss, actually wasn't borne out by the research data. So that was a pretty alarming thing, really. And also, when I looked further into the research, I began to realise that people could improve their health by making lifestyle change, whether or not their weight in fact changed. So I began to recognise that I needed to shift my focus from the focus on weight onto the focus on eating well for the sake of eating well and being more active for the sake of being more active. And it's not so much that I was against weight loss, but I was certainly against the pursuit of weight loss. And then there was two more things as well that were really, really significant in sort of changing my direction. One of them was the fact that so many people were so distressed, and rightly so, about the treatment that they'd received because of their weight, how they'd been devalued or insulted, both in and beyond healthcare, and the enormous courage it took for people with these experiences to come and see another healthcare practitioner. So I saw that whatever approach I was using, it had to explicitly address both size discrimination and also the enormous amounts of body shame that people felt. And then lastly, the last key factor was that it struck me that the areas that I was working in, there was a lot of deprivation, and it seemed that surely people's diet couldn't be the be-all and end-all when it came to health. And in fact, one day I was in a meeting in the department, and we were talking about high rates of heart disease in South Asian men in the city that I work. The city's Coventry. It's got the dubious accolade of being the furthest that you can get from the sea in England. And it had previously been the centre of the car trade, and when the car industry closed down, there was a lot of deprivation. And anyway, so we were talking about heart disease in South Asian men, which is double that of the rate in the general population. And we spoke about what you might think of all the usual culprits, ghee, smoking, sedentary behaviour. And it seemed to me that what changed most when people moved, say, from Mumbai to England was racism. And yet there was nowhere in the conversation for the potential impact of racism, I didn't know at this stage, but for the potential impact of racism on heart disease to be discussed. So when I left the meeting, I went and I researched it, and sure enough, I found that there's a wealth of literature showing that oppression, such as racism, such as homophobia, and also the stress of living with chronic poverty, independently impact on metabolic health. So the things that I was interested in as a dietitian, such as blood pressure and heart health, that they independently influence that, even if somehow somebody manages to eat well and keep active. So really, that was the sort of four key strands that set me researching another approach. And that's the approach that Linda and I describe in the book.
You know, you touch on some really interesting topics that, you know, like you say in the front of your book, that you know, that other books don't really talk about. And it's interesting that you're looking at the relationship between depression, racism, and not only heart disease but weight gain. What is that relationship directly?
I think the thing that's interesting is that very often weight gain is seen as a negative thing, but of course it's not necessarily. So I think what we need to do is sort of step back, and the metabolic pathways, if we're going to sort of single out one route for the metabolic pathway, it would be the hormone would be through cortisol.
Right.
So people who live with chronic stress have higher levels of high cortisol for longer than people who don't live with chronic stress, who when something stressful happens, the cortisol level and the other pathways that triggers cortisol will raise and the pathways will come into operation. But then when the acute stress has passed, we go back into our ordinary state, known as homeostasis. But for people where there is increased levels of circulating cortisol and a lot of stress, we can't go back into homeostasis and remain in a state called allostasis, which is sort of a long-term adaptation to living with stress. And it's that influences our metabolism.
You know, it's interesting that you're talking about that relationship, because there has been some studies that have linked cortisol levels to and stress levels to weight gain. But how do we get beyond that? You know, how do we get to losing that? Is it just a matter of chilling out?
That's a great question, and I mean the good news is that there's two things. That number one, it puts social determinants of health into the health equation. And that's really important. Because ultimately it means that if we want healthy societies, we have to build fair societies. So it puts equality and respect centre stage in the health conversation. And also, it doesn't mean just because we can see discrepancies within groups, it doesn't mean that if somebody is has had difficult life circumstances to start with, or is experiencing a lot of stress, that they are necessarily hurtling along the trajectory that they can do nothing about. And so on the one hand, we need to acknowledge social structures. On the other hand, we can work with people to help them become more resilient within difficult lives, and also seek to tackle the structural factors that are influencing them.
Okay, I want to come back to that after, but tell us a little bit about what are some of the facts and the fiction that surround weight gain.
Okay, where to start with this one? So I think one of them is that the idea that you have to be thin to be healthy. And of course, some thin people are healthy and so are some fatter people, and vice versa. So I think we need to knock that one on the head to start with, because if we begin to explore that one, then it makes dieting futile in the first place. Another one is that a very strong idea that this idea that people can and should be thin, and that you can achieve this just by spending more calories, burning off more calories than you eat. Now, we know this is fundamental to all sort of lifestyle weight change programs. And where is it holds true in the short term? Everybody will know people who've lost weight in a week, in 4 weeks. So short-term weight loss is almost inevitable. But in the same way that we've got regulatory systems for temperature, for blood gases, for blood pH, we also have regulatory systems for body fat that work in the long term. So this means that when we try and reduce our calorie intake, sure, we'll lose weight in the short term, but our homeostatic body fat regulation mechanism kicks in, and this works to push our us back to our set point. So we've all got a set point or a settling point that's pretty much genetically programmed. And we know this from the largest and longest study in the area, that was the Women's Health Initiative. So this was about 20,000 women followed for 8 years. And at the end of 8 years, the women in the control group, in the experimental group, were having about 360 calories less per day and exercising more, and their weight had pretty much stayed the same. And in the control group, rather than seeing weight gain, which is what we're often told, if we don't do anything, people are going to just carry on gaining weight, their weight has stayed the same as well. The idea that you just add willpower to calorie deficit and you'll lose weight is not borne out by the evidence.
You mentioned that that we're genetically programmed. So if our family is comes from perhaps a Eastern European background where they're traditionally big bones or a little heavier, is there any chance of us ever being skinny? Really, are we wasting our time trying to be skinny if that's the genetic predisposition that we have?
So whatever our set point and the genetic predisposition, we're not only wasting our time trying to fight it, but we're actually doing harm trying to fight it. So it's true that that our ethnicity is one of the factors that is going to influence our set point. And there's other things as well, for instance. So if a mother is very malnourished or undernourished when she's carrying the baby as a fetus, that child is more likely to be heavier than it would otherwise have been as an adult. So in other words, be above what its set point would have been. And moreover, that in itself, it seems, isn't the issue. Moreover, to have related health problems. When I say related, I don't mean related to the weight, but related to the metabolic dysfunction. So we can see from this that any moves to weight loss in pregnant women are, really a cause for concern.
We're talking with Lucy Aframore, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be finding out more about body respect and what you can do to live your optimum weight.